So this is the third lecture in Principles of Finance 1, and the topic today is investment under certainty. So we continue with our theme for the moment of living in a world where there is no risk, no uncertainty. So what we know today describes everything. We know today everything for sure about the future. Now that clearly is not the real world, and we will have to revisit that heroic assumption, and we'll start revisiting that assumption next week. But for the moment, let's have one more lecture where we live in a world of certainty. Why do I want to do this? Because I want to make sure we understand properly how to deal with the time dimension. I told you in my introductory lecture, and I reminded you on Monday, that there are two distinct arms to solving the problem of valuation. We want to be able to value risky assets. In this module, we're thinking about financial assets, like the shares of companies and the bonds that are issued by organisations such as companies or governments. Bonds acting as a borrowing instrument, a loan instrument. But two separate arms to solving that problem is A, being able to come up with a set of future cash flow forecasts, and I've already hinted at how we're going to do that in a world where there is risk. We're going to work with the expected future value. More about that in the lectures to come. The second problem that we have to address, which we have to address whether we're in the real world that's risky or this imaginary world where there is no risk, is how to deal with the fact that these cash flows are out into the future. What we want is a single number that represents value today. And we have to have a means of bringing back those cash flows, the value of those future cash flows, back to the present day. You've heard me explain in the previous lecture that that's discounting. I want to understand a bit more rigorously, without getting into too much detail, why it is that we have to do what I showed you in Monday's lecture. So in other words, a bit of theoretical underpinning to why we actually go about the discounting process in the way that we do. At the end of the day, in Monday's lecture, I drew an analogy with how a bank calculates compound interest, and with a bit of sleight of hand, I said to you, we'll just run the movie backwards to understand discounting. That was rather hand-waving. Now I want to put a bit more flesh underneath that story. Now, wherever I can, I want to keep the problem as simple as possible. Why burden ourselves with so much detail that we can't see the wood for the trees? So, for almost all of this lecture, we're going to be thinking about a single interval of time. In other words, a today and a tomorrow, a this period and a next period. So this is a very, very strange world in which there are only two instants of time that we care about. The story now and the story next period. So that's the time framework. Where I can, I'm going to draw diagrams to help build your intuition. The problem I want to look at today is one that economists refer to in a rather fancy way as intertemporal consumption. Now what that has to do with is how do individuals decide to consume their wealth today and tomorrow? This period and next period. The intertemporal bit has to do with the decision about how much do we spend or invest today and how much do we spend or invest next period. That's the intertemporal bit. So what's the story then? I want you to imagine this individual has a source of income today and tomorrow. Let's assume, for the sake of argument, that that source of income is work, employment. So that money comes to him or her from doing productive work. I'm trying to follow the conventions that economists use. Not that I've ever understood why this is the symbol. So income today, why not? Income next period, why one? That's income from a source such as employment. The question is, what will the individual do with that income? Well, here is one possible behaviour. My axes are as follows. Along the horizontal is the amount in wealth terms, in money terms, consumed today, this period. And up the vertical axis is the amount in wealth terms consume tomorrow, or next period. This point in the diagram represents an individual who spends what he earns. So all of his income this period, why not, is consumed this period on whatever he likes to spend his money on. If it's me, it's bars of chocolate, whatever. Next period, the guy spends all of next period's income. Because we're in a world of no uncertainty, I know today those two numbers. There's no uncertainty about how much income he has next period. We know everything today in this risk-free world. But that's not the only thing an individual could do. Depending on their preferences about consuming today versus consuming tomorrow. Someone who's patient, someone who is quite happy to put off some of the consumption, if you like, save for a rainy day, may consume less than all of their income today, with a view to consuming more next period. There's the extreme case of that. Someone who decides to defer all of his consumption today. He fasts. I ain't going to spend any of it today. Instead, I'm going to save it until next period. But he doesn't put it under the pillow. That would be dumb. He puts it in a bank account where it can earn interest. And we're in a risk-free world, so the rate of interest is the so-called risk-free rate. I call that big R. His reward for deferring all of his possible consumption today is that he can consume a great deal more next period. He can consume all of the income that he expects next period, say from employment, topped up with whatever is in his bank account 1 year from now. And if he invests all of today's income, why not, for one period at an interest rate big R, the balance in his savings account is why not times 1 plus R. So this individual who sits at this point, he consumes nothing today. Instead, he consumes all of next period's income plus what he's able to generate by investing today's income in a bank account that pays big R for one period. So that's a very patient individual who can postpone or defer consumption completely until next period. What about his opposite? The really impatient individual who can't wait at all, who spends money today like there is no tomorrow. So this individual is going to consume all of this period's income and is going to borrow money from a bank in order to spend even more. Now, there's a limit to how much he can borrow from the bank, and that limit is determined by the income he knows for sure he will have next period, because he can show that income, he can point to that income as collateral in order to persuade the bank to lend him some money. Now, the bank won't lend him all of next period's income. The bank will want to get that back next period. So the most this chap can borrow against next period's income as collateral is next period's income divided by 1 plus R. Why am I dividing by 1 plus R? Because the bank will want its loan back with interest. And Y1 divided by 1 plus R, invested, growing at a rate of R for 1 year, gives me back Y1, and the individual will have exactly Y1 from next period's earnings to pay off the loan plus interest. So those are the two extreme cases. Individuals, in fact, can sit anywhere on this so-called budget line. The more they're happy to defer their consumption this period, the further to the left and up they sit on the line. The more impatient they are about wanting to spend more today than their current earnings, the further to the right and down they sit on this line. Convince yourself that the slope of the line, this is important, is minus brackets 1 plus big R. So the slope of the line is controlled solely by the risk-free rate. What am I assuming in drawing the diagram in the way I have? That the rate of lending When you invest money in a bank account, you are lending money to the bank. So next time you go to the bank to pay some money in, assuming you have some spare cash, if you're standing in a long queue, by the time you get up to the cashier, you remind him or her, you know, I'm actually lending you some money. I don't appreciate being kept in a queue when I want to lend you some cash. I'm assuming that the rate of riskless lending is the same as the rate of riskless borrowing. That's an assumption. That's what makes the graph a single line segment. Now let's make the problem a bit more interesting. Suppose there's another investment opportunity. I'll call it a capital project, for want of a better phrase. In other words, now our individual can choose between three courses of action. Consume some of your wealth today. Save some of your wealth, lend it to a bank, or borrow against next period's wealth, some of next period's wealth, in order to consume more, or, and this is the new dimension, invest in this capital project. Now, the terms of this capital project, again, are known today for sure. It's going to cost big I for investment. It's going to cost big I today. And in return, one period from now, it's going to pay you back a cash flow of C1. And today, we know both those values. In the real world, we would know I, because that refers to today, but we would have to forecast C1. But there's no uncertainty in our model. So my graph starts off looking like the graph on the previous slide. I've tried to reproduce the key points. So just convince yourself, once again, that this point on the budget line refers to an individual who consumes what he earns. He consumes exactly his income in each of the two periods. Lenders, individuals who are willing to save some of this period's income, sit up, higher up on the line. Individuals who wish to borrow against next period's income so that they can consume more today, sit somewhere down this line. Note this point. Note how far to the right that is, because that's a limiting point, and we'll come back to that. So now let me introduce this additional investment. In order to sit here, our investor is no longer consuming all of this period's wealth. Instead, he's investing an amount I in this capital project and consuming the surplus. That's why this point is at Y naught, today's income, minus the initial stake in the capital project. In return, next period, he will have income from earnings next period topped up by a surefire cash flow of C1 from the capital project. Now, for this problem to be interesting, this point has to sit above the original budget line. Otherwise, we wouldn't even think of doing this. So it's not an accident. Remember, the slope of the line, the slope of the budget line was minus brackets 1 plus the risk-free rate. The risk-free rate is the rate of interest you can enjoy by putting some of your money in the bank account. This project had better provide a higher rate of return. It's important, therefore, that the line that joins this new point to the original point slopes down more steeply. Its slope will be minus brackets 1 plus whatever the rate of return on the project is. And we want that to be bigger. Otherwise, the individual wouldn't consider the project. If he doesn't want to consume all of his wealth this period, he'll just save some of it in a bank account. So it's not an accident that this point is up here. Just as before, on the previous slide, we can then start to generate this line segment. It's parallel to the original budget line because it represents different combinations of lending or borrowing. So it has the same slope as the original budget line. That slope is again minus brackets 1 plus the risk-free rate. Now let's make sure we've got all of the numbers clear in our mind. Just convince yourself for a minute then that the height of this new budget line on the vertical axis is as it appears on the slide. Convince yourself that the distance to the right, where the new budget line cuts the horizontal axis, is as it says on the slide. It's important that you can reproduce those expressions. It's important you understand what's happening here. And it might help to look back at the previous slide, where, if you like, big I is zero. So the previous slide is a special case of this slide. So what's happening here is, at this point, the individual is deferring all of today's consumption, apart from investing an amount, big I, in the capital project. So what's left over, the surplus income, Y not minus I, all of that's invested in a bank account where it will earn the risk-free rate big R and will therefore grow to this amount. That is then topping up what the individual knows he will receive from earnings next period plus cash flow from the capital project. So make sure you understand why that point is at that height. Likewise, at this point, again, the individual is investing big I in the capital project. The balance of today's income is being consumed. In addition, he's borrowing against next period's income. Now, next period's income is Y1 from employment, topped up with C1 from the project. So that's all of his income next period. That can be used as collateral. That's the most he can borrow today in order to be able to pay off the loan plus interest next period. So convince yourself that you could reproduce this diagram. As you'll see when you attempt some of the seminar problems for the second week of seminars, this distance is important. The distance between the point where the new budget line cuts the horizontal axis, remember the horizontal axis refers to how much is being consumed this period. The distance between that point on the new budget line and the corresponding point on the original budget line is the NPV of this capital project. And we need to convince ourselves that that's the case. So, what I'd like to invite you to do, it's not exactly rocket science, is write down an expression for that distance. That expression doesn't appear on your notes. What appears on your notes is what you end up with after a little bit of tidying up. So convince yourself, it's not exactly difficult, that this horizontal distance is set simply the difference between these two expressions. Now you see why it's important to be able to write down each of those two expressions correctly. Now let's just do a bit of tidying up, and we recover exactly the sort of expression for the NPV, net present value, that we saw in Monday's lecture. So now perhaps we have some deeper understanding of why the NPV is the quantity we will want to evaluate to decide if a capital project is a good investment. In fact, the NPV is what we'll want to evaluate in order to decide if any investment, be it in financial assets or real assets, is a good investment. Our individual is rational. Our individual will always prefer being able to consume more this period and next period to less this period and next period. In other words, our individual is always going to be happier the further up and out to the right he sits in this diagram. I said to you it was important to realise that this point, which was the first point we plotted for investing in the new project, the capital project, it's important that that point sat above the original budget line. By moving the budget line upwards and to the right, we're making the individual happier. We're adding value. And the amount of value today that we're adding by undertaking the project is this distance. That's what NPV means. So maybe now you have some better understanding, thanks to the diagram, of why NPV greater than zero is our criterion for deciding if we should invest or not. Okay. But there's more. What makes this approach so rewarding is what I'm going to say to you about this slide. There's a big message coming, so hang on in there. Again, I've reproduced the key parts of the diagram on the previous slide. I don't want to complicate it with any unnecessary detail. So the inner budget line refers to the situation when there isn't a capital project. The outer budget line refers to the situation when the capital project is an additional investment opportunity. this line that connects those two points, remember this point corresponds to an individual who consumes what he earns in each period. This is that individual in the absence of the capital project. This is the same individual now deciding to invest in the capital project. It's important that the slope of that line be greater, be more negative, than the slope of the budget line. Otherwise, the individual will never invest in the project. Investing in the project is not as good as saving some money in the bank account. So that's the configuration that we have before us, without loss of generality, because we're only interested in projects that add value. What I want to look at now is, what decision does each of a number of different individuals reach regarding investing in this project? You know, I've talked a little bit glibly so far about the criterion for investing is to look at the NPV and see if it's positive. Well, I hope that all such individuals who are contemplating this investment agree. We'd all better reach the same decision. Let's make sure that that happens. So the first case in point then is someone who decides to invest in the capital project, so that consumes big I of his or her wealth this period, spends the rest of today's wealth on whatever their favourite goods and services are, so that's Y not minus I, spends all of next period's wealth from earnings, etc., together with the surefire cash flow that comes from the capital project. So that individual votes with his thumb up. The project is a good investment. What about the individual who sits over here? How does it work for them? Well, that individual also invests in the capital project, so that consumes an amount big I. That individual isn't interested in consuming anything else today. That individual is a very patient person who is happy to invest all of the balance of their income today in a bank account where it will earn the interest rate big R. So that individual, next period, will consume all of their income from earnings, the surefire cash flow from the capital project, and the total amount that sits in that bank account. And remember, that's the initial investment times 1 plus big R. Let's look at one further individual, the individual that sits down here, because this is a very impatient individual. This person spends like there's no tomorrow. This individual invests in the capital project. This individual consumes all of their remaining income today, Y not minus I, and borrows up to the hilt against next period's income. Now, next period's income is what they have from their own earnings, topped up by the surefire cash flow from the project. So this amount is the maximum that any bank will be willing to lend them. So they borrow that as well and spend that. So their consumption today is given by this amount. What's the message behind the slide? The message behind the slide is three individuals with very different preferences regarding consumption today versus consumption tomorrow all agree that the capital project is a good investment. None of those three individuals decides not to invest in the capital project. Now let's take it one step further. Any individual, regardless of where they sit on this budget line, will agree to invest in the capital project. What will differ, what will separate one individual from another, is how much of their surplus wealth this period they will consume versus how much they will choose to save to consume next period, or indeed borrow additional money to consume even more. The three individuals behave quite differently in terms of their intertemporal consumption, but what they have in common is they all agree that the capital project is a good investment. And the reason they agree the capital project is a good investment is the slope of this line is bigger, it's negative, but it's more negative than the slope of the budget line. Why is that so important and interesting? It's what lies at the heart of shareholders investing money in companies but allowing the senior managers of those companies to get on with running the company. The real implication behind this cartoon-looking diagram is investors can delegate the running of an organisation to a third party in the safe knowledge, at least in a world where there's no risk, in the safe knowledge that those individuals they entrust the running of the company to will make the same decisions as to what to do with the company's money as the shareholders would make themselves. Where the organisation, where the company is having to consider individual capital projects, are they a good investment, are they a bad investment? After all, it's by investing in positive NPV capital projects that companies grow. The shareholders can rest easy at night in the safe knowledge that the senior managers will make the same decisions as the shareholders themselves would have made, because regardless of consumption preferences, impatience versus patience, everyone agrees on whether the project is a good project or a bad project. So there's something fundamental going on in this rather simple looking diagram. But for this to be true in this risk-free world, it's important that the riskless lending rate and the riskless borrowing rate be the same. It's important that the slope of this line segment be exactly the same as the slope of this line segment. If that's true, if the rate of riskless lending and the rate of riskless borrowing is the same, then something called Fisher separation holds. And I need you to know what Fisher separation refers to. What is it that separates according to Irving Fisher? What separates, if this condition holds, is the investment decision from the consumption decision. What that's saying is, regardless of individual preferences about consumption today versus consumption tomorrow, all individuals will agree on capital investment decisions. So that's the Fisher separation principle. And that's what enables shareholders to delegate the running of companies to managers. The shareholders are often referred in the economic literature as the principals. They are the owners of the firm. The managers are the agents. So in this world with no risk, where in addition riskless lending and riskless borrowing are possible at the same rate, the thinking of principals is entirely aligned with the thinking of agents as far as capital investment is concerned. So just let the agents get on with it and go do something else with your time. So there, I hope, is some help in understanding why, when we're looking at a one-period investment, our criterion for deciding whether that investment is a good investment or a bad investment is to write down an expression for the NPV and check whether it's positive or negative. So what can go wrong? Well, we have to spend a minute or two looking at the situation where riskless lending and riskless borrowing are not at the same rate. That's the real world. Because in the real world, it costs more to borrow than it does to lend. It's a bit like when you're planning to go on holiday and you want to buy some foreign currency to spend whilst you're abroad. So how much of the foreign currency can you get for your pound sterling? Whatever the exchange rate is that the Bureau de Change offers you. So you go off and have your holiday, have a nice time, but you don't spend all of your money necessarily. So when you come back to this country, you've got this surplus foreign currency in your hand and you don't know what to do with it. So you think, I'll exchange it back into sterling so I can spend it in this country. And you discover that the exchange rate isn't as favourable as it was the other way around. In fact, we lose on both legs of the trade. And so it is with lending and borrowing. If you want money from the bank, they're going to charge you a higher rate of interest for that loan than they would be willing to pay you for any money you're willing to lend them in the form of a deposit or savings account. So in the real world, the rate of riskless borrowing, RB, is greater than the rate of riskless lending, RL. How does that affect the diagram? Well, instead of having a single budget line now, the budget line is in two segments. They don't have the same slope. Remember, the slope of the line is always minus, brackets, 1 plus big R. If big R is the riskless lending rate, so we're sitting up here, then the budget line is configured like so. If, on the other hand, we're looking at borrowers, so the riskless lending rate is now the riskless borrowing rate, that's bigger than the riskless lending rate, so the line segment slopes down more steeply. So the budget line takes on a kinked appearance. Why does that make any difference? Why should that change our earlier conclusions? Well, I remind you once again that when it comes to deciding if an investment, a capital project, is a good investment or not, we have to compare the slope of this line. So this slope is minus brackets 1 plus RP, where RP is the rate of return from the project. And that slope had better be more negative. We want the rate of return on the project to be bigger than riskless lending or riskless borrowing if we're going to incentivize a lender or a borrower to invest some of his or her money in the project. If the situation is as it appears in the left-hand diagram, then everyone will agree. Both lenders and borrowers will agree that the project is a good investment for the simple reason that the slope of the line that represents investing in the project and doing nothing else, the slope of that line is more negative than the line segment for lenders and the line segment for borrowers. So if this is how the three rates of return stack up, in other words, the rate of return on the project exceeds both the riskless borrowing and the riskless lending rate, then all individuals will still agree that the project's a good investment. But if instead the rate of return on the project sits in between riskless lending and riskless borrowing, then they no longer agree. Remember, we're always comparing the slope of the line that represents investing in the project alone with lending or borrowing. And in the second configuration on the right-hand side, because the rate of riskless borrowing is greater than the rate of return on the project, borrowers, so that's individuals who are impatient about consuming today in preference to consuming next period, they won't invest in the project. So Fisher separation breaks down. We no longer have the result that all individuals agree that the project is a good investment. Is this the end of the module then? Because 5 minutes ago or so, I made the big statement that really my simple diagram, even though it looked a bit like a cartoon, painted a rich picture that explained why individuals are prepared to invest some of their surplus wealth in the shares of companies and allow other individuals, the managers, to get on with the business of running the company. I predicated that on the conclusion that all individuals, regardless of their preferences to do with consumption today versus consumption next period, all individuals would agree on every single investment decision, whether it was good or bad. But that won't be the case now. So, how come we have any companies in the real world? Have I destroyed my own story? Well, I have, if the world we live in is risk-free. But if we start to admit the possibility of risk, and risk is all-pervasive in the real world, perhaps we can rescue that situation. So one of the hidden messages behind this rather annoying diagram, which is messing up my story, one of the implied messages is this cannot be an adequate description of the world, because if it were, we've got a job in our hands to explain why indeed individuals with surplus wealth are willing to entrust that wealth e.g. by investing in the shares of companies and allowing third parties, namely the senior managers, to run those companies on their behalf. There must be more to the story than we have captured so far. And what is seriously missing, of course, is any consideration of risk. And risk, of course, is what we're going to start to think about next week. What about the multi-period dimension? What about the multi-period dimension? Well, we could go through a similar argument. I don't think we'd learn anything particularly from doing that, so I'm going to ask you to take it on trust. The multi-period case works in exactly the way you'd hope and in exactly the way I implied in Monday's lecture. Here's my little cash flow diagram for the single period case, and there is our NPV expression. And there is our criterion for investment in capital projects or not. Is the NPV positive or negative? How does that generalise to the multi-period case answer in exactly the way that I suggested in Monday's lecture? What we are doing is grabbing hold of each of the cash flows in turn, so C1, 1 period from now, C2, 2 periods from now, etc., etc. We're calculating the present value of each of those future cash flows. We're adding up the present values, and then we're netting out the initial investment, and we're checking to see if the total is positive or negative. What do you notice? Well, I hope you notice that the discounting of each of these cash flows is at the same rate, big R. Why is it at the same rate, big R? Because so far, we're in a risk-free world where there is a single riskless rate. What I'm trying to suggest to you is it's all well and good doing things in the simplest terms so as not to confuse ourselves, but we must never let go of assumptions that we are making. Start to get in the habit of reminding yourself of what assumptions lie behind whatever you're writing. When I look at this equation as is, I'm reminded of several things. I'm reminded that we live in a risk-free world so far because we've already agreed that big R is the risk-free rate. I'm reminded that we are assuming that riskless lending and riskless borrowing are possible at the same rate because I don't see any distinction between RL and RB in this formula. There is a single, one-size-fits-all risk-free rate. I'm actually assuming something else. I'm assuming in the jargon that the term structure of risk-free interest rates are all the same. What do I mean by that? That the risk-free rate to use for discounting a cash flow that's 1 period into the future is the same as the risk-free rate that should be used for discounting a cash flow that's 2 periods into the future. This doesn't say R1, R2, R3, etc. So I'm assuming that the risk-free rate to use, regardless of how far out into the future is the cash flow, is the same. In the jargon, the term structure of risk-free interest rates is assumed to be flat. That's the assumption I'm making behind this slide.